Okay, so one of the thorniest ethical problems that's been dealt with in recent literature has been the question of what exactly to do with self-driving cars. I was talking to Ray Broyd last week, right after he gave the shiur here. He said he gave half a semester worth of this at Stanford last semester, dealing with some of the issues. We talked over, and we basically agree on why this issue is particularly complex and why it's hard to actually draw firm conclusions. So we may not draw firm conclusions, but I do want to discuss the issues. So before we get into the halachic sources, let's define what we're talking about and then deal with sort of the way it's framed in classic philosophical literature and policy literature, and then we'll get into the sources. So there is some discussion in if you go on YU Torah, you'll see there are like 10 different shiurim on self-driving cars. Most of them will deal with what we're dealing with today. Ray Yonah Reis deals with one other topic, which is the question: if you're in a self-driving car and it causes damage to property, are you liable? That's an interesting question. Not actually that complicated. The harder question are the life and death questions. So that's what we're going to focus on today. So most of the questions that come up are a variation on what has become known in philosophy as the trolley problem, the trolley car problem. There are certain things in philosophy that, you know, if you do a philosophy major, you just at some point need to have come across. The trolley car problem is one of them. The categorical imperative is another. Things like that. So what is the trolley car problem? Right. So it was first introduced by Philippa Foot in an article in 1967. So what is the problem? So there are different variations, but the basic one goes like this: if you are driving a car, you are in a trolley, and you are hurtling down the street. Something goes wrong with the trolley, whatever the case may be, and now you only have two paths in front of you. If you continue on the path that you're on, so then there are five people that are going to be hit by the trolley, whatever variation you want to come up with. They're tied to the tracks. There's no way of getting them off of there. Or you can pull a lever and shift to the other track, and then you will kill one person. What do you do? Right, that is the classic trolley car problem. Now, what is the philosophical question that this is supposed to test? Yes. Yeah. No. No, really. What is it supposed to test?
That if you let it run its course, like five people are going to be killed, but if you switch it, you actively kill one.
Good. So, in philosophy, though, we have formal terms for this. So, in order to understand as the question was classically put, it was meant to test whether people believe in what's known as consequentialist theories of ethics, or utilitarian is a subset of consequentialist ethics. Just means that you think ethics are defined by the consequences. One subset is utilitarianism, where the consequences you're looking for are the most happiness for the most number of people. But you could have other consequentialist theories. There are other theories of ethics, but the other version that's usually brought in here is what's called deontological theories of ethics, meaning ones that focus on the inherent virtue, the inherent morality of the act itself. Right? And the way it was presented is as follows. Right? So if you are in the... I'm not even going to try bothering the car, riding the car, whatever you are, right? You're in this thing, this vehicle. Right? So now you have the option of continuing straight, where you'll kill five people, or switching to one person. So the question goes as follows. From a consequentialist or utilitarian perspective, it's clear that you turn and you kill the one person. But on the other hand, potentially, if you view this from a deontological perspective, so then murder is wrong. To kill the five people is not an act of murder because you didn't choose to be here, right? The trolley, something malfunctioned in the trolley while you're going on the road. If you do nothing, so it's not you, it's the trolley, will continue and kill five people. But if you shift, you are choosing to kill. Admittedly, choosing to kill one person but you're choosing to kill one person. So that is the classic trolley car problem, which is supposedly supposed to put up consequentialism versus deontological theories of ethics. Now, there are a million different variations of this, and if you look at the end of the source sheet I gave you, if you want, maybe we can either do this at the end, or if you want, we can do this right now. I don't know, maybe if you want to do this right now, we can do this right now. To test the variations on this, MIT has put together a ethical simulation where you can test 13 different cases. What would you do? And then it varies it, right? What if it's, they mix it between, numbers of people, what if there are animals involved, men, women, all types of different combinations. I mean, you can look at the end. It's interesting. I took the test myself, and I think I'm just not even, attuned to some of the things. Like, until the end of the test, I didn't realize that half the question, certain of the questions looked exactly the same to me, and I didn't realize till the end that they had differentiated whether it was men or women being saved, and I just didn't, process that was even part of the question, but they were testing whether people would save people differently based on sex. So I did not even notice that, but that's okay. But that's the basic trolley car problem. What? Well, you're supposed to notice that. You're supposed to. They're asking you what you would do. You're actually supposed to notice that. I just didn't. Right? This isn't like a. It's not like trying to trick you. They want to know what they're trying to gauge public opinion on what you would do in these variations because they're all complicated, right? If someone, people who believe, which I obviously do not, right? This I think is not. I know this is not a controversial statement within halacha, right? If the choice were killing three dogs, right, or one person, I would kill the three dogs, right? There are people to whom that is not clear, right? And if you look at the MIT thing, you'll see that there are some people who that's not clear to them, right? To me, that is clear, right? I would always prefer the human being over the animals. But they're seeing what the public opinion is, and that's not obvious to everybody. Should be, but it's not. So this is one version of it. But there are many other versions of this. So, for example, and this is what you get there, and different philosophers have come up with different versions. One of them that we're really going to have to deal with is the version as follows. What if the choice is not between 5 and 1? The choice is as follows. If you continue going and you kill the 5 people, the driver will survive. The alternative is to push the lever and ram into a wall, which will kill nobody but the driver. So now things get a little bit more complicated, because now the question is there a special role to self-preservation? Right? Are you allowed to prefer your own life, try to save your own life? Now you can flip this, right? You can have this in two ways, right? You could have it in this version where you can be passive, kill 5 people, or active and kill yourself, or you could flip it, right? What if this is the wall, right? And the given is that I would kill myself, right? Or I could save myself at the expense of others, right? Right? This is obviously a very different ethical question. We'll get to the self-driving in a minute, but not necessarily. And we'll talk about this in just a second. There are other versions, yeah. You would hope, but you'll see that's not always the case, yeah.
This is kind of like that feeling like something that's kind of commendable, and there's a bomb.
Correct, right? So when it comes to yourself, that can be in two ways. Do you have the right, on the one hand, to preserve your own life? Alternatively, do you have the right to sacrifice your own life in a way you might not for somebody else, right? Meaning, it could go either way, right? You could say, if I'm going to die, I have the right to save myself, right, and continue and kill the 5 people. On the other hand, you might say, look, I don't have the right to kill somebody else to save 5 people, and I have the right to sacrifice myself to save 5 people, right? You could, right, these are all theoretical possibilities. And the philosophical literature is very complicated on this. I put at the end of it, I put several. If you're interested in the philosophical accounts of this from a halachic perspective, so I gave you a classic article in the Torah Mada Journal by Michael Harris, with a link. I don't think I gave a link, but it's on YUTARA. You can find it there. Called Consequentialism, Deontologism, and the Case of Shimon ben Bichri by Michael Harris. And then more recently, my chavrusa of many years, Rabbi, almost doctor, Shlomo Zuckier, wrote an article in the Torah Mada Journal as well, called A Halachic Philosophic Account of Justified Self-Defense, which had then responses. It was a. Did any of you know the website, the APJ, the Association for the Philosophy of Judaism? If you're into analytic philosophy and want to study analytic Jewish topics using analytic philosophy, so it's a website that was put together by several analytic philosophers who are from Jews. And they have symposiums once a month, once every other month, where they take a paper and back and forth. It's worthwhile checking out. So they had a symposium on this paper, which was fun for me. Not only with Shlomo Mechavrusa, but this was an expansion of a final paper he wrote when we were in YU, when we took a course on the ethics of war and Judaism, something. So if you're more interested in the philosophical perspective and a lot of the variations on this, you can look there. This is not about self-driving cars. It's about the broader issue. And there you'll get a lot of discussion. What exactly does it mean? Why do we preserve the self? Is it a right? Is it a moral responsibility? All different types of things. Now, there are variations on these. And if you look at the second page, there's the fat man variation. This was introduced by Judith Jarvis Thompson in 1976. And here it's not a question of turning the train to, right, to save the five and then killing the one, but it's a car hurtling down, and you can stop the car by shoving a very fat person who is not in danger in front of the trolley, and it will stop the trolley. Is that okay? Right there, by the way, most people have an intuition that that's not, right? They do have a certain sense of deontologism that you can't actively, right? Even people who think you should divert it, that's because both of them are on the track and, you know, this is sort of inevitable, but I can't actively kill, right? Maybe it's the same, maybe it's not. In philosophical literature, it's a bit of an open question. Yeah?
If you divert the trolley, like, from five people to one people, it's not yourself. It could be seen as, like, taking the act.
Correct, and that's part of the difference, and we'll see that in halachic literature as well in the Chazon Ish, right? That one of the ethical differences might be that if I turn away from the five, the act I'm doing from a deontological perspective is saving five. So maybe you could say even from a deontological perspective, it could be that you're allowed to turn and kill the one because you'd say, yes, I'm killing the one actively, but that's not the definition of my act. The definition of my act is saving five. But if I shove the fat person onto the train, there's no way of interpreting that rather than I'm killing the one to save the five, rather than I'm saving the five and happen to lead to the death of one. Yeah?
So, if you decided not to pull the lever and let the five people die and let the one person survive, would you be responsible?
So, possibly. Right? I mean, responsible. So, that's an interesting question in terms of responsible. Right, you didn't commit an act of murder, right? The trolley went out of control. You didn't initiate it. Do you bear moral culpability for something? Potentially, if you think it was the wrong decision, right? Then you do. It's not murder. It's, you know, whatever. Not a right. It's lack of responsibility in saving people's lives. If you think the right thing to do was to divert, then there is the fat villain variation, right? Which is, what if the person that you're shoving deserves to be killed, right? Then can you do it, right?
By your standard?
What?
By your standard,
deserves to die? Again, open question. By your standards, objective standards, who knows, right? But this is a variation on it. And then there's the loop variation, right? If you can, I'm looking at my phone, so it's harder. But right. This is the. Right, in this variation, as a standard case, the trolley is hurtling towards five innocent people, and there's an option to divert it onto a sidetrack which has one person on it, but in this case, there's a loop in the track which takes the trolley back to the original route. There's also a probability that if you pull the lever, the trolley may actually stop on the sidetrack and kill no one. But alternatively, it may not stop, but will loop around and head back down the original track again towards the five people. So by pulling the lever, there's a chance, which could be 50-50 or other probabilities, that no one will die, or that one person will die and the train will return, requiring you to decide whether to pull the lever again. This could repeat many times, although the chances of it doing so decrease, such that although the choice each time is to kill one to save five, ultimately you end up killing more than five to save the five, right? Did that, right? So they're all complicated versions of this. Again, if you go online, you go on YUTER, you'll see, and others, you'll see, I gave you a link, right? Anthony Manning has a helpful share on it, where he has a very nice source sheet. I found one on YUTER. There's one by the person who took over from me in Toronto, by Ray Sammy Bergman, where I took some of the English material from, and some from Ray Manning. I found one of them that, to get the picture across, he put a 2-minute clip from, what's it called? The Good Place? The Good Place?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I was trying to think of earlier, because I was trying to think, like, where have I heard this trolley call before?
What, is there a video? Can I?
Yeah, we have
one. Yeah. How do I?
Do this?
If you have a computer, then you can.
I don't have a computer on me.
I think there might be one in the office. Look. A computer. I have a computer.
Okay, so let me, I'll discuss it outside while we're getting it ready, but we can watch the 2 minutes of it. It's a particularly vivid, explication of this. Okay, but this is the trolley car problem. Now, again, before we see the sources, I want to be clear. Many people will argue that the self-driving car issue, so what is the self-driving car issue? We haven't even discussed it. What is it? So self-driving car issue is as follows. Normally, it's very hard in real life to deal with the trolley car problem because you're talking about someone who's driving a car, right? And it's instantaneous what you do when you start hurtling towards something. But when it comes to a self-driving car, we actually need to make a choice. We need to program the self-driving car because, yes, self-driving cars are objectively, if all of society were in self-driving cars, it would objectively be safer, right? Because the computers could drive closer to each other. They're not subject to a lot of the whims that we have. They're not falling asleep at the wheel and the like. But what's the problem? At least until everybody has self-driving cars, there are going to be mistakes and it needs to respond. And the self-driving car is programmed to do something, right? And what do you do when you're programming a self-driving car if the self-driving car is now faced with saving the driver or killing other people, ramming into another car, or assuming it can tell, ramming into two people versus three people, or a dog versus a person, right? All those things. And the question suddenly is, well, how do I program it? Do I give preference to the driver? Do I give preference to passivity? Do I give preference to utilitarian principles? Is it different? And this is what people have not really answered. Is it different than the choice you would make yourself? Meaning, does the fact that it's programmed in advance change the equation for one of two reasons? On the one hand, you might say that maybe as individuals we are deontologists, right? Because we are responsible to act virtuously. But the self-driving car doesn't have an ethical standard. And therefore, it's legitimate for the government to insist, or companies to insist, that it be programmed from a consequentialist perspective. Counter that with, and that sort of to add to that is the reality that, do governments think in utilitarian terms? Of course they do, right? Think about healthcare, right? If you have a social, right, take socialized medicine, right? Any country with socialized medicine has to take this into account. They have to have triage, right? They have to. If they're not going to spend all their money on healthcare, they have to decide, are we always going to provide medicine for one person to save their life if the cost of that is potentially not saving 20 people or 100 people, right? Or do we save every person that we can and therefore give up on R&D? And, right, give up on the possibility then the future of the disease won't exist, right? That's a real, right, you have to think in consequentialist terms. Balance that, though, right? That would be an argument to say that even if you decided that you were a deontologist when it came to the trolley car problem, you would be a utilitarian when it came to self-driving cars. But counter that with the question of, can you ethically, or should you ethically, ask someone to buy a car that's programmed to kill them? right? Or to not kill them. It's programmed to prioritize someone else's life over their own, right? Can you do that to somebody, right? Right? Because on the one hand, you might say, yeah, the government can be utilitarian while individuals can be deontologists, or individuals can prioritize their own life, and the government can prioritize the many. But the question is, yeah, but individuals need to buy those cars, right? Should people be forced to buy cars that don't prioritize themselves over other people? And again, we're not going to come to firm conclusions, but this is the ethical problem that we have to deal with, and we'll see what halachic sources have to say about it. Yeah. Correct. We had triage questions in terms of saving the terrorists, serving, saving victims. Yeah. We also have it in terms of, right, there are a lot of halachic questions in Israel about triage in the healthcare system, because here you have halachists involved, right? You have people who care about Torah. And in any socialized medicine, right, any government run, and again, everything gets more complicated because Israel's a bit different than other countries, right? I mean, right, and you know, you can always get into the question, right? Is it different in a country like, let's say, England, where it's a one-payer system, so the government makes all the decisions, right? It gets more complicated in Israel, where the government pays for your health insurance, but you choose your kupa, right? So there is individual choice. How does that fit in, right? Because now the government is making certain decisions, but there's also market forces, right? And all this, right? All these things get very, very complicated, very, very quickly. Okay, so yeah, if you want the 2.5 minutes of to understand in a visual way why this is a question which tears at philosophers' hearts, even though it very rarely happens, though with self-driving cars it's back. So do I have to explain The Good Place? Okay, so I was only, when I was recruiting in October, when I was in England, I sat down I was sitting down with another educator, come to me in a second, who I was sitting with. I was sitting with Rabbi Aaron Baer. And we were just having lunch in between recruiting. And he said to me, if you haven't watched The Good Place, you have to watch The Good Place, because it creatively teaches philosophy. The premise, at least as I've gathered from the first few episodes that I've watched, is that this group of people are dead and are in The Good Place, which is some... I will not ruin the... any more than that, but they're in The Good Place in the first... They're in The Good Place,
yes.
And they're in The Good Place, right? That's it. They're in The Good Place, which is heaven or something like that. And one of them is... The main protagonist of it, you find out already in the first episode, so I'm not ruining anything, doesn't belong there. She's a terrible person, and she thinks a mistake has happened, and she's really a horrible ethical person, and her soulmate in this is a philosophy professor, a professor of ethics, and those are two of the main characters that you meet, and he's trying to finish his book, which he never finished in life, his 3,600-page manuscript or something on philosophy, and at some point, I don't know exactly when this comes up, they decide to test philosophy. I don't know what season this is from. They test the philosophy of this in these vivid simulations. So, is there a light that would make this easier?
Yeah, can we turn off the light?
I'll pause the recording, but for anyone in the recorder who wants to look it up, it's 2.5 minutes. Good luck. Okay. So that's the trolley car problem, right? That is what it looks like. I'm just going to pass this around so I can keep talking.
Okay.
So that is the trolley car problem. Okay, so let us... So really the way that people have dealt with it, because again, Halacha doesn't have a trolley car problem, is that they have taken classic sources that seem to speak to the broader question of deontology versus consequentialism and come up with with principles to figure out... What does halacha hold about this? Okay, so let us look at the first Hebrew source here, the Tosefta. This is going to be annoying, but okay, that's fine. Okay, so the Tosefta says as follows: Si'ah shel bnei adam she'amru lehem goyim. If you have Jews, right, of people who these, right, the mythical evil non-Jews in this, the marauding crusaders, I don't know, whatever. They say, "Tnu lanu echad mikem v'nahargeyu, v'imlav harehanu hargin et kulchem." Here's your choice: give us somebody to kill, or we'll kill all of you. I was going to say pass it around, but if you want to do it, that's great. So what do you do? So what does the Gemara say? So right here it is, utilitarianism, right? Obviously, what's the answer on a utilitarian perspective? It's someone's definitely going to die. Give them somebody. What's the problem from a deontological perspective? Right, you can't give them an innocent person. So what does the Tosefta say? Yehargu kolan, yehargu kulan, not yehargu, sorry. Yehargu, they should all be killed. Val yimsru la nefesh achat mi Yisrael. So they should all die. Okay? They should all die. Right? You can't give an innocent person to them. You can't make that decision. The result is that you all die, fine. But no one is allowed to make the choice. Okay? That's clause one. In favor of deontology. Aval, im yichduhu lohem, kigon shi yichdu l'sheva ben bichri, yitnu lohen va'al yargu chulan. But, if they don't say give us one of you, they say give us that person, or we'll kill everybody. So then, what's the halacha? You give them that person. What's the logic? So, what's the potential logic?
You're not picking someone.
So, there's two possibilities, right? Clearly you're not picking, but why does that change it? So, one possibility is that, right, it takes the deontological problem out of it because you're not responsible for killing that person.
You are responsible for
sending them to them. Ah, so, and we'll see in the next line in a minute, right?
Well,
correct. The other possibility is to say, like, no, essentially this person is already a dead person because he's been picked out, and therefore it's not a, this is not, right, it's not just a, right, there are different ways of viewing why this solves the problem, right? Is it that now I'm not making the decision, right? Or is it, or the person's already dead, right? Is this a, wait, what exactly is, but it's still fundamentally utilitarian, but the Gemara then says, if an Amar of Yehuda, b'medvar mamurim, Bizman sha shehu bifnim vehem bachutz. Bizman shehu bifnim vehem bifnim. Howl vehu neherag. Vehein neheragin. Yitnuhu lahen. Va'al yargu chulan. Rabbi Yehuda says, now it's not totally clear what he's saying, right? Who he's talking about, but he says, it really depends where they are. If they're still on the outside, so then, to give them a person, you are giving to them. But what if they say this once they're already within the walls? So then, that changes the calculus, because they don't need you to give over the person. Right? If they're outside the wall, you need to make the decision. But if you're within the walls, I mean, they're already within the walls, then everyone's a dead man anyways. Right? Everyone's going to die anyways because you're within the walls.
Why can't they just take the person they're looking for and go outside and kill
them? Well, they can. Right? They could, but they're asking you. So he says, but then the calculus is different. And the Gemara says, and the Tosefta says, V'chein hu omer, v'davo yishal kol ha'am v'chokhmata. And the Gemara proves this, and the Tosefta proves it from, right, so Rabbi Yehuda seems to say that this is only true, right, when it's inevitable, right? But if you could prevent it, not. And then you get, then they prove it from the case of, so this comes from a case of in Shmuel, where Yoav ben Tsruya is looking for this person named Sheva ben Bichri. Sheva ben Bichri had rebelled against the king. So he says, look, I'll kill the city if you don't give me Sheva ben Bichri. And a woman in the town says, fine, takes his head, right, cuts off his head, throws it over the wall, and that's how she saves the city. So,
if he rebelled against the king, wouldn't he be, like, deserving of death?
Good, so that's what Reb Shimon says. Reb Shimon Omer, kach amar lehem kol mar malchut beit David chayav mita. Reb Shimon says, no, the reason that in this case you give over Sheva ben Bichri is not because he was specified, but because he deserved death. Right? Because this particular person deserved death, that's why you could give him over. Right? So the question is, how do you define this story? So one way of reading it is to say, right, what does Reb Shimon argue? Reb Shimon argues, look, even if a particular person is singled out but they're innocent, are you allowed to give them over? No, because that, right, that's a deontological problem. Right? You can't do that. The only time you can do it is if the person deserves death. Because then it's not a deontological problem because the person deserves death. So their murder is either legitimate, right? It's not murder, it's execution, right? Or their life is worth less as it is, right? But Shimon argues that there is no such thing as ever shifting the balance on and allowing you to give the person, unless the person deserves death, but you can never give an innocent person, as opposed to the first position of the Tosefta, who says, no, that's not true. If you have to make an active decision to kill someone, so then you're never allowed to do that. But if they make the decision, you're allowed to facilitate it under certain circumstances, because simply the fact that that person now is the most likely to die, right, that changes it. Rabbi Huda says, I'm not sure. Depends on how inevitable this is. Are you in or out of the gate? Yeah.
So within that line of reasoning, what do we do with Arayufa?
What?
Like, if we have someone who was a murderer, but like he murdered accidentally, and then he has to run to a city where he can take refuge or whatever, like, what do we do with that Dean? Like, do we have to hand him over then? Because he is deserving.
No, so that's the interesting question, right? That someone who killed by accident, right, we assume is not really deserving of death fully in the execution sense, but he is... I mean, that's a bit of a complicated question because it's unclear.
Is
both in the Gemara... Well, part of the issue there is it's not clear in the Gemara whether we assume that someone who killed by accident really does at some level deserve death, right? Or at least potentially, right? And this is an execution, which he can get out of by going to the Yer Miklat, right? Or is that a case where, no, he really doesn't deserve death, and the Torah, in very, very limited circumstances, recognizes crime of passion defenses, right? Which is how some Rishonim understood it. It seems to be machloket in the Gemara, because the Gemara has a machloket. Does the Gol Adam have a mitzvah or permission to kill the murderer before he gets to the Yer Miklat, right? Meaning, assuming he doesn't get to the Yer Miklat, is he allowed to or does he have to try to kill him? Which, again, it's not clear. Is that person, right? But that's an accidental murder. It's not clear. He's sort of on the line. We're not clear. Does he really deserve to be killed or not? Which is what complicates it. Okay, this is the Tosefta. The Mishnah in Trumot tells you that the same thing is not true, not just true, but the same sort of calculus of utilitarianism versus deontology, right? Deontologism is not just true in murder, it's true in rape as well, right? That if you had Nashim Shamru Lem of Dekel Chavim Tnu Echat Mikem Nitma Vimlav Reinu Mitamin Mit Kulchem Mitamut Kulam Nim Shulam Nefesh Echat Mizrael. The exact same calculus, right? If the choice was given, either, right, give us one woman to rape, or we'll rape everyone, right? Exact same calculus. You can't do that. You can't give somebody over. There's a difference between active and passive. Now, this gets complicated in the Yerushalmi, because in the Yerushalmi, you get the following. Tani, si'ot b'nei adam she'o malchin b'derech, pagulahem goyim v'amru tnu lanu echad mikem v'naharogoto v'imlav anu hargim et kulchem. Oh, sorry. This is not the complicated Yerushalmi yet. The Yerushalmi just builds on this and says, right, here's the story, same one that we saw in the Tosefta. A few ne'eragim lo yimzru nefesh acham Yisrael yichdu lohen echad kigon sheva ben bechri yimzru oto val yargeyu and amar Rosh Hashem ben Lakish v'yushi echayv mitah kisheva ben bechri yochan amar afal b'yishenu chayv mitah kisheva ben bechri. Right, in the Yerushalmi it's very clear that you have this case and there's a machloket. Reb Shimon holds that unless someone deserves death, you can't give them over. And Rabbi Yochanan says, no, the fact that someone is singled out makes it different. Again, does that make it different on a, presumably on a deontological level, that now you're not making that choice, and therefore it's not fully considered that you are involved in this. So which way do we paskin? Right now, either way, it's clear that in halacha there is a level of deontology, right? That's clear, meaning you can't make, right, that's the first point that becomes clear from all of this, which is that halacha does not believe that decisions are made purely on utilitarian grounds when it comes to the individual, because for an individual to be engaged in the choice to kill somebody is, right, that's murder, right? What they dispute is what would shift it such that someone else would be making the moral decision, such that you could now make the utilitarian decision. Essentially, right? Meaning, shift the burden of the act of murder and then leave you with utilitarian calculus because the murder is essentially both inevitable and shifted to somebody else, and then you have a machloket. Rare Rebbe, where Rabbi Yochanan, sorry, Shimon says, the only thing that will allow you to shift that calculus is the person actually deserves death, but an innocent person, you always have to, right, sort of stay out of the decision. You can never make that choice. And Rabbi Yochanan saying no, right, once someone is already, right, singled out, so then you can, singled out, you can, or then you can, right, let it go in that direction. Now, according to this, right, in the classic trolley car problem, would there ever be a case where you could turn the car based on just this? It would sound like not, right? Unless perhaps the person deserves death, right? If you saw someone's on death row on the right on the other side of the track, right?
You can't make that decision because then you're making an active decision.
Right, but you might be allowed to in such a case, right? Because he already deserves death. Right, maybe. Though it might not be true, because it might be that still you're killing them, that might be worse. And that's going to be nearly impossible to program into the self-driving car. I guess not impossible. Yeah?
A few things. One is that, is it telling you that if they give you, if they single out the person, you have to give them over, or you can't give them over?
Good. So... wait, did it... no. Okay. I thought I put this on, but I guess I did not. So there is one more Yerushalmi. I thought I put this on. I'm sorry. Okay. I guess. Oh, whatever. Let's look at the Rambam in 7. I meant to give you the Yerushalmi the Rambam is based on, but we'll see the Rambam. The continuation of the Yerushalmi says as follows. I just cut the Yerushalmi off early. Continuation of the Yerushalmi says as follows, which complicates the picture. So, I think it was Rish Lakish. He had a case like this, and they designated the person to be given over. So he gave him over. And Eliyahu used to come to visit... again, I think it was Rish Lakish, to talk to him. And then at some point he stopped coming. And Rish Lakish said, why'd you stop coming? He said, because you're a murderer. He said, what do you mean I'm a murderer? That's the halacha. They designated the guy, so I gave him over. And Eliyahu said, you're right. It was mutter. But, lav mishnat chasidut hu. That's not the right thing to do. That's not how pious people act. Right? Meaning pious people would not do that. Right? You're just... so maybe it's... you can, but you still shouldn't. Right? So if you look at the Rambam in number 7, he says, Nashim Shamru Lahem Avdeko Chavim Tnu Lanu Achat Miken Vinitmauta Vinitameota Vimlav Nitameet Kulchen Itamu Kulan Valim Surun Lahem Nevej Achat Misrael Vichen Imamru Lahem Avdeko Chavim Tnu Lanu Achat Miken Vinargenu Vimlav Naro Kulchem Yaro Kulam Valim Surun Lahem Nevej Achat Misrael. Vim yichdu, right, so again, this is what we've seen, right, the women case, the rape case, the murder case, vim yichdu, and if they designate a person, v'amru tnu lanu ploni l'naharoget chulchem, im haya mechuyav mitak yishevim ben bechre, yitnu otan lahen. So he pachtened like Rabbi Yochanan, sorry, not Rabbi Yochanan, like Rabbi Shimon, that only if the person deserves death can you give them over, and he says, but, vim morin lahen ken l'chadchila, but even in that case, it's not the best thing to do. You shouldn't tell them to do it, right? As the Yerushalmi says, "Lav mishnat chasidim hu." You should never, ideally, it's not illegitimate because objectively speaking, that person's life is worth less because they're mechuyav mita, but still, the choice to kill somebody is still an ethical problem, and ideally you should avoid it. It's not usher, it's not forbidden once the person is mechuyav mita, that's the stricter standard. And even if they designated somebody, the Rambam paskin strictly and says you are not permitted to choose to take the life of somebody, even in a case where the murderers made the decision for you. And if you look at Shulchan Aruch in number 8, he writes, Ovdei kochavim shamlu Yisrael, tenu lanu achan mikem min argenu, lo yitnu lahem, echad mehem, elem gen yichdu v'amru tenu lanu ploni, v'yishom ramfil chayigav in l'masro, elem ken chayav mitakish avim bechri. He notes that there are two opinions l'halacha, whether we say that you're never allowed to give somebody over unless he's mechuyav mita, or unless he, objectively speaking, doesn't deserve to live, or as long as someone else has made the decision and singled out the person to be killed, so then that shifts the moral responsibility from you. So, just from these sources, people have pointed out that the burden, right, the preponderance of evidence, shall we say, points in what direction, that halacha is more utilitarian or more deontological. It's more deontological, and therefore, in the trolley car problem, and therefore potentially in the self-driving car problem, we will always prefer the decision. Well, you know, in the trolley car problem, if you're actually driving the car, which decision will we prefer? The one in which you're passive. Right? The only question is, what happens if there's an individual who, for some reason, is already designated to be killed? Does that change the equation? Now, if you think it's only someone who's chayav mita, obviously there's no relevance in most trolley car or self-driving cars versions. Right? Could you come up a case of yichdu, right, where someone's life is sort of inevitably going to die, right? It's, I don't know, come up with the case, right? Either it's going to kill, I don't know, you have to come up with a creative case. But it would say that in general, right, however exactly you parse it, the balance of the evidence points in the direction that halacha will choose the deontological approaches and therefore choose passivity, right, rather than a utilitarian approach to save the most number of people. And then the Meiri argues that even though there is a bit of a disagreement, right, at what point your the fact that someone else designates somebody to be killed, does that make it legitimate for you to give that person over? He says there is a limit to that. No one's going to hold that you could kill the person actively, right? Meaning, even if you think that the fact that someone was designated to be killed shifts some of the deontological burden onto the person who is designating the person to be killed, and therefore legitimates giving them over, no one will say you can actively murder them, because there are still gradations of giving over, right? Where the primary ethical burden is on the person who's killing them, right? And your ethical responsibility was not to give them over. And that can be mitigated if the people designated that person and their life is going to be sacrificed anyways, because you're all going to die, or just that person's going to die. But you could never actually engage in murder, per se. And that's what he says, become akam yirash luhutar lamasro lo shema yikach menu kofer o yitchari lavalargo biadayim lo. And he says, the reason is, he adds a little bit of a twist, which is the following. Part of it, I would say, is that, right, the primary burden rests on the person who kills them. You can never be in that. He adds another thing, which is, part of the reason you can do it is because you're not sure the person's going to die. Right? If they say, give us that person and to kill, or we'll kill all of you, including that person, he says the reason you can give over the person is because there is this tiny little thing, which is, maybe I'll give him over and they won't kill him. So it's really, there's a little bit of doubt. And that comes back to that trolley car loop problem, where maybe morality changes when you know for sure, rather than, right? And this is where things get complicated. What if, and most cases are like this. I don't know I'm going to kill 5 people or 1 person. I know with 90% certainty, right? Or 50% certainty, right? And that complicates everything, because the Meiri says, right, if I knew that I was going to kill, like, so then, obviously, I would always go on the deontological thing. I can bring in utilitarian issues a little bit in cases of doubt, right? In cases of doubt, and obviously that complicates it in self-driving. What if it's not, I know I'm going to kill somebody, it's I know I'm going to hit somebody, right? That's a different equation, right? I know I'm going to hit somebody is different than I know I'm going to kill somebody. Okay. Now, yes. Oh, so look, that's the next source. Right? But he says you can never kill the person, be a dayan. Right? You could never kill the person, right? Actually, slice off their head. Good. So, but this doesn't fully answer our question. It tells us that the balance is on deontology. But there is a complicating factor, because we're so far assuming that this is simply a question between deontology and consequentialism. But the Chazon Ish says that's not really true. Right? The Chazon Ish says, wait a second. That's if I have a choice to kill or to kill. But maybe that's the wrong way to conceptualize this case. Maybe if it's 5 versus 1, this isn't even a deontological problem. Because I define this act not as killing one, right? But I define it as saving 5. Right? And therefore, maybe from a deontological perspective, it's legitimate to shift it, because it wouldn't be legitimate to, right? Well, right? Turn on the trolley, knowing it had to go on, right? And initiating it to kill the one or something like that, I don't know, right? Come up with some case. But maybe there's a difference between the case of killing someone and a case of where I'm trying to save the 5, and it happens to be that I turn and kill one person, still, deontologically speaking, is viewed as saving and not as killing. Yeah.
But are you saying, like, there's a situation where there are 6 people and you're trying to save all of them, but in, like, the best case scenario, you're saving 5?
Well, no, he just says, look, he says, what happens, right, in this case, we've been viewing it as, if I choose to keep going and being passive, so that's a deontological decision, because switching the track would be killing one, right? From a utilitarian perspective, the question isn't murder versus not murder, or killing versus not killing, it's how many people will be dead by the end. Well, the Chazon Ish says, I have a deontological way of framing it, which is, this is not the exact same as the case in Tosefta, right? This is different, because why am I switching the track? Not to choose to kill one person, because I'm trying to save 5. And if I could end up on this path, I would, but maybe that's not an option. But maybe you define the act not as murder, but as saving, and therefore that would permit going and accidentally killing the one. Or, right, again, you could have middle cases, like the Meiri says. Maybe it would be different if it was a suffix, right? Maybe this would be different. Maybe you could say, I can't do it if I'm definitely going to kill the one, but if I'm 90% going to kill the one, but at 10% I'll kill nobody, then it would be permitted because I'm not actually engaging in killing the one. I have 100% chance of killing the 5, right? A 90% chance of killing the 1. So I'm doing it also because I don't know that this is murder, right? And again, you could do 90-10, you could do 50-50, right? What if it's 50-50, right? What if I turn off, I might kill, I might not kill. But if I keep going, I'll definitely kill. Does that change it? Again, you might think it does, because now I'm not choosing to kill the person, I'm choosing to try to save these people at the possible expense. My ideal is not to, right? Would that be different? Yeah.
I think it's also interesting when you start thinking about, like, how passive your life is. It's like, let's say you have, like, an 80% probability of killing an elderly person, or, like, a 50% probability.
Good, so that's one of the things on the MIT thing is, does it matter if they're old or young?
Well, yeah.
Right, does that matter?
But also the probability of, like,
correct, probabilities, or all those things, and that's why I said, we're not going to come necessarily to firm conclusions, but I want to point to the sources that help us inform this decision. So the Chazon Ish is the one who brings up the saving point. And this is what he writes. V'yesh la'ayin, be'echad shera chet halech la'arog anashim rabim, v'yachol ato l'tzad acher, v'yarog rak echad shebetzad acher. If you see a arrow which is going to kill people, that was his case, and you could turn it and it'll kill one person, v'elu shebetzad zeh yitzolu, and the ones in the path of the arrow now will be saved. Vimlo yase, if you don't do it, kulam yargu. All of them will be killed. Rabim ve'echad yisher b'chayim. Ve'eshad lo l'damin l'mosrim. Echad lahariga dozim asiri pula achzariya. Sharigad nefesh v'ulad zeh leka atzalat achirim. B'teva shel pula l'amikre garam achshav atzalat achirim. He says, maybe you could say that, look, giving somebody over to the murderer, to the marauding, right, whatever, right, the crusaders, is an act of killing, or at least an act of giving somebody over. Pulling the lever is an act of saving the 5. And therefore, deontologically speaking, right, it is not the same. That's possibility 1. But as he said, possibility 2 is that it's worse than giving somebody over, because at least in the case where you give over somebody, it's not the Miri. You're not killing them actively, right? So you could say that moving the lever is better than giving over the person to the murderers because you're trying to save five. It's an act intrinsically of saving. Or alternatively, it's worse because at least when you give the person over, you're not actively killing him with your hands. You're just allowing him to be killed, right? Rather than here where you are ramming into the one person. And that's what he says. Maybe this is worse. Right? So it's not clear. He said it could go either way. I don't know what the answer is. 11. If you look at Mishnat Pikuach Nefesh, Siman Nun, this was a shaila they brought after 9/11. This is the question they wanted to know. Yesh la'ayin. Here's the theoretical question: Im nachtov matos ve'rotzim achotfim lefotzitzol binyan rav kamo kedil arbor harugim k'maseh arav v'netu min be'artzod abrit. Right, you have a plane which has been hijacked and now is heading towards a building. You're allowed to blow up the plane before it reaches its destination. Right? Same question. Right? You're actively killing the people on the plane to prevent them from ramming into the Twin Towers.
No, but everybody on the plane is going to be
dead. Exactly. That's what I'm saying. You're killing. Right? Can you do that? The simplest understanding is you're not allowed to do that because this is active murder to save, and we don't do that. But he says, on the other hand, you could say it's different. Why? Because you're not, the people on the plane are going to die anyways. Either way, they're going to hit the building. Right? So maybe this is different. But maybe not, because we say you're never allowed to do that. But he said maybe the Chazon Ish would tell you you can. Right? You can't just blow up the plane, because we say that even when it's one who's definitely going to die and everybody's going to die, you can never do it actively. But he said maybe you can conceptualize this not as murder, but as saving the people in the tower. But he said, but maybe this is even worse, because at least moving the arrow can be conceptualized as saving. Blowing up a plane, the act you are doing is killing the people on a plane. And he says, he's not sure. He just doesn't know the answer. So the only thing he knows is that if it were only the hijackers on the plane, obviously it could kill them, right? That's obviously true, right? But this is a very hard case, because can you conceptualize this as... Do you conceptualize this as an act of murder? Do you conceptualize an act of saving? Because you're saving them, right, from the plane. Yeah?
Why did he give the answer if he doesn't know? Because obviously, like...
He doesn't know. Correct. But sometimes the answer is you just, you know, you don't know.
But that's, is he worried that, like, if he gives it a sock, then people won't use it?
I don't know. I just assume, no, I assume that sometimes the answer is you just don't know. Right? He said, I don't know. I would be stuck. I don't know.
But, yeah.
I know. I understand. I don't know. I don't know.
So,
yeah.
Isn't it an issue to give a sock on an issue where it's really up to the person's, like, jurisdiction in the moment?
This is the interesting thing is that, right, again, for an individual, I don't know how relevant this is, because how much are they going to be able to think about it in the moment? But when you're dealing with policy, right, like what should the government do? Or policy, how should you program self-driving cars? That's where you really actually have the time to think about these questions. And that's why these questions have come back. Or the reason that these went from being philosophical questions that philosophers sat and thought about in class to ones that people think about in real life is because when you're programming it, you really can sit down and call up and say, well, what do you think I should do? Because you're programming it, right? You're not, this is not in the heat of the moment. The computer has no heat of the moment. It's a computer, right? It's a self-driving car, right? That's why these issues have come back.
Right, but
I know, I'm just asking about
Holocaust. Right, so again, so though the answer is, well, so the answer is that maybe for an individual it would be hard, but for a government, right, government really does make this in advance, right? Government knows that eventually they'll have a situation like this, and therefore they do make policies, right? That's why you ask. Okay. The Tzitz Eliezer, in number 12, writes about this Chazon Ish, and he writes, V'zot l'dat, ki ha-chakira Chazon Ish, Hanal hilorak teoreti v'teir tzir dimoni shal riyat chet talich larog ve'eich ha-shiyish ha-rila t'tokam ha-shir z'chazon ish. This isn't only a theoretical question. Ela she'ela ma'asit ma'mashiti. It's an actual question. V'yish l'ach ha-chor al-doma l'zeh. Kigon ha-kli rechav k'shenosim b'domeh v'mashal v'niklaim b'domi l'fnei anashim rabim v'shchosim v'erik v'ish. Right? He said this is, all these questions are, in the end of the day, the question of you're driving and suddenly the car goes out of control. And the only thing you can do is turn it, right? That's the question. Right? So this is a real question. Don't think this is theoretical, right? This really is the car question. etc. And he takes it as obvious that the answer is you're not allowed to do anything. You have to be passive, right? He takes it as obvious that in the car case you have to be passive. He doesn't buy the Chazon Ish's possibility that this is an act of saving. He takes the Chazon Ish's other possibility that no, this really is still conceptualized as an act of killing. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's Eliezer now says that which the Chazon Ish said. Right, he talks about a theoretical case of an arrow, but the Tzitz Eliezer said this is the car case, right? This is the car case, but he doesn't buy the saving distinction. Okay. This is, so on balance, right, on balance what do you have? Halacha is mostly deontological in the sense that it will always prefer passivity, with the possibility, and this is subject to machloket, that maybe in certain cases you can conceptualize the act of saving, right? Even when it takes the act of killing, right? It's part of it as an act of saving, and therefore even from a deontological approach, it would be permitted. But that's a big if, because no one's quite clear about it. It might change if the statistics change, right? Because then you'd say, I'm not choosing to kill, I'm choosing to not kill 100%, right? On 100% chance, I'm choosing to 50-50 kill less people, right? That might change the equation. Okay. The other complicating factor to this, as I mentioned, though, is this is always when the question is killing five versus one or something like that. But often, the case is not five versus one. The case is the driver versus people. Does that change the equation? So here, we have a lot of sources that point in the direction that it might. Because Halacha recognizes that when it comes to life-saving, in addition to all the principles we have, there is a right to self-preservation, or an ethical obligation of self-preservation, that might weigh more than other things. So, for example, as a general principled statement, the Gemara in number 13 in Bava Tzinis Samach Bez tells you that, you probably know this case, right? Two people are walking along in a desert, one of them has water. He only has enough water for one of them to survive. So it's a machlokas. Ben Petera says, split the water. You can never, right, stand by and let your friend die. And what does Rabbi Kiva say? Drink it yourself. Now, the problem, so that tells you self-preservation, right, comes first. If it's a choice, one and one, you always get to choose yourself. Right, that's what he says. Ben Petera doesn't agree, but we don't pass like Ben Petera. The interesting question, though, that Post can ask is, what if it's not you, it's a third person? I don't know why this is true, right? How a third person got here, I don't know. With water, that probably wouldn't work, but I don't know. A third person is there, and they both start having a, right? They both have an anaphylactic reaction to whatever. No, I'm saying you come up with a case, right? There's one EpiPen, and a third person has it, right? Then what does he do? Right? Is he allowed to choose to save one of them? Right? Is he allowed to? I don't know. Come up with a case. Come up with something.
How can you choose to not save them? Like, if you have the EpiPen, then you gotta save one of
Right, you gotta say, well, I don't know, or medication, right, that will say, I don't know, come up with medication that either you could split it, which will give them a few more hours, right, whatever, I don't know, come up with a case. I don't, okay, which complicates it. But at any rate, the Gemara tells you that when it comes to yourself, the equation is a little bit different, yeah.
Does anybody say you should save your friend?
No, nobody says that. Okay, now how far does this go, right? This is sort of a generic one, but how far does this go, this right to self-preservation? And again, if you look at the article I put in from Shlomo Zuckier, there are different ways of conceptualizing that right to self-preservation, and there's a, you know, in philosophy, we can argue from now till forever, is it a right, is it a privilege, is it a this, whatever. There are all types of different ways of putting it. I don't want to get into that. But to see how far this goes, so look at number 14. So I'll say some of this outside. In 14, I gave you the classic sugya of rodef. Right? The general halacha is that if someone is chasing someone to murder them, so what are you allowed to do? What are you obligated to do? Kill the rodef, right? Kill the potential murderer. The Gemara then continues and tells you that there is a... how many mitzvot are there that are cardinal sins? Yareg val yavor. Three. It's machloket, but that's what we paskin. Three. Yes, and the Gemara, some people think it's only one, only Avodah Zarah. Okay. Yes. So the Gemara says as follows. Why are these Yahareg val yavor? So the Gemara gives a pasuk for Avodah Zarah. Why does the Gemara say that murder is Yahareg val yavor? So the Gemara says, "Mi Amar," this is the last line in 15. "Mi Amar didama didach sumak tvei delma dama dahugavra samuk tvei." Because maybe who says your blood is redder? Maybe the other person's blood is redder. So this Gemara tells you there's a limitation on this. That on the one hand, if it's a choice of saving you or your friend, we paskin, you save yourself, and you don't try to save your friend. On the other hand, if the only way to save yourself is by killing someone, right? Someone holds a gun to your head and says, either kill that person or I'll kill you. What's the halacha? You can't kill them, right? So there is a preference to yourself, but not at the expense of active murder, right? You can never engage in active murder. Now, the one of the questions, though, and this comes back to what we started with, is the Gemara's phraseology is, "Mi yemar d'damar v'agavra sumak tvei." How do you know that your blood is redder? Maybe his blood is redder. So there's a machloket. Does that mean, right? Is that a... like a real statement, like, how do you know? Or can you ever say this? Yeah. Right? Meaning it's rhetorical. Yeah. Right? Now, some people assume, yeah, this means that you can never make that statement, human life is always equal. Other people say, no, 99% of the time you can't say that's true, but maybe it is true in certain cases, like the Sheva ben Bichri case. Right? Maybe the logic of the Sheva ben Bichri case is that usually you can't tell, but if someone is mechuyav mita, right, you do know, and that's why we treat his life as less valuable, because we know his life is less valuable. Yeah. Correct, and that's what the Meiri says. Though I've heard people argue in that Meiri. I won't say who, because when I challenged that person said, you know, it's against the Meiri, he said, oh, okay, whatever. Against the Meiri, but it was a prominent posek who once said, maybe that's not true, maybe you can, in certain circumstances, actually kill Biadaim, I'm not sure. Yeah.
But also, the whole thing about, like, knowing that your blood is better than Sheva ben Bichri, like, I feel like that's, like, just because of the law that...
Well, it's not that he broke the law, he's mechuyav mita.
Okay, but that doesn't... Like, I don't know, that's, like, because he broke the law. It's not... That doesn't...
Well, he broke the law and deserved capital punishment. I mean, not as a bad person, it makes his life forfeit. Okay, right, well, but that's really the question there. But, I mean, that's what Meiri assumes, but... at any rate, right, the Gemara here says... Right, so we see here that there's a limit, though. Right? On the one hand, you have preference for your life. On the other hand, there's a limit to it. Right, you can't actively kill someone at that expense. Okay. However, the Gemara in Sanhedrin a little bit earlier says the following. There's another halacha of Baba Machteret. What's the halacha of Baba Machteret? If someone is burrowing into your house in the middle of the night, so what are you allowed to do? You're allowed to kill them. And the Gemara says, why? Because habar lahar gecha ashkem lahar go. Right, the Gemara's logic is as follows: he knows that you know that he knows that you know that whatever, right? That you will never just give up your money, and therefore he's ready to kill you, and therefore since he's ready to kill you, you can be ready to kill him, and you can kill him. And the Gemara says, why? Because Abba Lahargecha, one who comes to kill you, Ashkeim Lahargo. The way the Gemara phrases it here is, right, it's one versus one. What legitimates killing them? It's not just Rodef. This seems to be unique, halacha, when someone comes to kill you, Abba Lahargecha, Ashkeim Lahargo. Now, how do I know that it is not just... I'm going to skip around a little bit. How do I know that this halacha is not just the same as Rodef, right? That the guy is a murderer, so I'm allowed to kill him. How do I know? So there's a few reasons that I know that this points in a direction of a broader, a broader right to preservation of life. One is that this is not a case where he said he's coming to kill; he's coming to steal. So it's a case of suffix. And the Gemara goes through, under what circumstances can I assume he's coming to come and kill me, and therefore be allowed to kill him? But it's not that you need it 100%. It's that if I know he's not coming to kill me, then I can't. Right? If it's in the middle of the day, then we assume that he can't, that you can't. But even though he's fundamentally coming to steal, and I don't really know for sure he's going to kill me, so the fact that I have the right to preserve my life on doubt points to the unique status of my life. Another is that it's not clear the way that this psychological thing worked out. Meaning, according to many Rishonim, it sounds like the argument here is, I would never give up my money. And therefore, he, if he's coming in the night, has to be ready to kill me. And since he's ready to kill me because I'm not willing to give up my money, right, and therefore I would kill him, I can actually kill him, right? Which sort of puts the, right, makes it that the whole, psychologically speaking, the whole chain started from the guy saving his money, right? The conviction that he would kill him is what actually makes him allowed to kill him. Now, admittedly, he didn't initiate the act, but there is one more way, and this is what I'll say as follows. This is a Gemara a little bit later on.
But I feel like that doesn't prove that. Would he be willing to kill him
with your money? So it's a machloka, what exactly is going on, but the assumption is that, right, it's potentially that it's because you would be willing to kill him, therefore he's ready to kill you, therefore you actually can kill him. Which, again, is not really fair because he initiated the whole situation. Okay. But there is a better proof to this, which is the following. The Gemara has a case, we're running short on time, so I'm going to have to say this a little bit outside. The Gemara in Pei Beis introduces the following halacha. There's a halacha called Kanaim Pogimbo. That there are certain areas of halacha where you're not actually chayav mitah, you're not actually liable for the capital punishment if you commit a crime, but if someone catches you in the act, they have the right but not the responsibility to kill you. Right? So, such as... They have the right but not the responsibility.
What does that mean, the responsibility?
Right, meaning this isn't a capital punishment, right? They're not acting as Beit Din, right? So the classic example is Boel Aramit, right? From the case of Pinchas, if someone catches someone in the act of sleeping with a non-Jewish woman, he has the right but not responsibility. If someone is a kanoi, someone is a zealot, they can kill the person, but they don't have to. But the Gemara says, if in such a case, the person sleeping with a non-Jewish woman would turn around and kill the zealot, would they be chayav mitah? So the Gemara says, no. Right? He has the right. If Im nehepach, nepach zimrivar, go le pinchas, ein neheragalav, share rodefu. So what's the problem here? Right, what's the problem? Normally, in a case, right, let's say, you have a murderer, right, chasing after somebody, so the guy turns around to save his life. Okay? Does the murderer now say, ha, that's what I was waiting for. Right, if I shot you from behind, so I'd be a murderer. But instead, I waited until you turned around and were ready to save your life by killing me, and now you are trying to kill me, so I can kill you and get off scot-free. Does that work?
No.
Obviously not. That's ridiculous. Right? So why does it work here? Why is it the case here that the person who's committing the crime that put him in a situation where Pinchas has the right to kill Zimri? Why is it that if Zimri turns around and kills Pinchas, that's legitimate, when a third party couldn't? Right, a third party couldn't come and say, Pinchas, don't kill Zimri. Right? He couldn't kill Pinchas because Pinchas is allowed to kill Zimri. So why is Zimri allowed to kill Pinchas, but a third party can't kill Pinchas? Right? And why is that not true by a normal case of murder? And the answer seems to be because, look, if a murderer is trying to kill someone, so obviously the person that he's trying to kill is allowed to defend himself, and that doesn't give any rights to the murderer. And a third party can only kill the murderer, right, obviously, but can't save the murderer from the victim, because the murderer is the aggressor. But in a case of Kanai and Pogimbo, when the zealot has the right, but not the responsibility to kill the sinner, so a third party can't get involved. Why? Because the zealot has the right to kill the criminal. But the criminal is allowed to kill the zealot because the zealot doesn't have the responsibility to kill him, he's just allowed to. And therefore, it may not be murder for the zealot to kill him, but the right to self-preservation means that he's allowed to save his life, even though Pinchas is allowed to kill him. Right? So this proves, pretty unequivocally, that the right to self-preservation is not identical to the right, right, to other rights, and it can be invoked even in cases where the killing is actually legitimate. I mean, that's what the Ron comments on in 24. Right? I won't read it inside, but that's basically what the Ron clarifies, that by murder this won't work. But here, yes, he's not liable. So yes, a third party can't come and kill Pinchas, but you always have the right of a bala hargecha hashkem lahargo. Another indication of this is as follows. The Mishnah says the following in number 20. If a woman is in labor and she is dying, and the only way to save her life is to kill the fetus. So what's the halacha? Kill the fetus. Until what point? Right, until its head comes out, shein docha nefesh bifnei nefesh. Okay? The Meiri has an interesting discussion there, which is, the Gemara there says, why aren't you allowed to kill the baby? Isn't the baby a rodef? Right? Which indicates that rodef in halacha is not only about moral culpability, right? I mean, the baby is killing the mother. Right, so can you kill the baby? So what is the Gemara saying? No, the baby isn't really a rodef. Mishmaya karat filahu. It's really nature, it's God. Right? This is just the way of the world. Fine. The Meiri, though, raised the following question. Okay, so the Gemara says that the doctor can't kill the baby once the head comes out to save the mother. But I have a different question. What if, in theory, the mother were capable of saving her own life by killing the baby? Would that be legitimate?
Oh my God.
It's a horrible case, I understand. But in principle, are you allowed to? So the Meiri has a machloket about this. And he quotes the Chachmei Adorot that you can. Right? The Chachmei Adorot say, in theory, if the woman wanted to, she could. Because she probably wouldn't, right? But in theory, she could. Why?
Because the baby's a rodent.
Because in the end of the day, the baby has no moral culpability, but your right to self-preservation means that if someone is killing you, right, even if it's not their fault, but if they're killing you, you always have the responsibility, the right to save yourself. Not responsibility, the right. Right now, Miri himself doesn't like this, but he quotes the Chachmei Adorot. So there is this, and again, however you want to deal with that case, you could say that case is different, and you don't have the right to do it because it's not the baby, it's God, right? That's what you can just extend that. But the fact that the Chachmei Adorot are willing to entertain it highlight again this principle that self-preservation halacha is a bit different. Yeah.
It just reminds me of, isn't there a case in the Gemara where the sun is breaking on the father can kill the son?
So that's in Bava Machter, where the Gemara assumes that it would never happen, right? If a father is breaking in to steal from the child, we say Bava Machter doesn't apply because the father would never kill his child no matter what, right? Now, that may be the case. Right? Well, I'm not saying a mother would ever do this. I'm saying the Chachmei Adorot just say, in theory, he has the right. Right? She has the right. Not that she would do it, but she has the right because, again, self-preservation is a different category of halacha. Yeah?
Saying it's not the baby, it's God, does that assume that there has to be a man in order to be a rodent?
There has to be a what? No, not necessarily, because a child who's trying to kill can be killed. Like, not a baby.
That's the child's intent.
What?
No.
Mean intent, but not morally culpable intent. Right? I mean, that everyone agrees to. So that if a kid is trying to kill someone, the kid can be killed. Right? Even though he doesn't have morally recognizable intent. Right? So it's, the baby case seems to be unique in halacha. Right? Because the baby, right, it's not, yeah. Well, that would, that's obviously the twins are not deciding. It's the...
No, like one of them is killing the other one.
Oh, potentially, right? Potentially that would be a relevant factor. Right. Now, I will point, obviously, just remember, self-preservation is a thing, but there are limits. The Shidim Kubetzit makes the obvious point that in the two people with the water case, what can definitely not happen? Someone can't say, look, well, my life is important. I'm going to steal the water from you to survive. You can't do that because even though it's not technically murder, right, the same principle goes that self-preservation doesn't allow you to deprive someone else of saving themselves if they have, right, if they have the water, right, because now the, right, they have the presumption that they will be the one to survive. Okay, we are running short on time. So again, there are slightly different issues here. The Chazon Ish has a few more nuances in that case, but I won't have time to read them, so you can look at it yourself. A few more points. So we've said that on balance, halacha is deontological. There's a possibility that self-preservation is a little bit different, which would mean that, right, possibly if I'm driving the car, right, I have the right to save my own life, right? So, right, you're hurtling along, you have the right to, let's say, slam the brake if it'll save your life, even if that means possibly that the car will, you know, flip over and hit somebody, right? If you're going straight towards to the wall, right, you have the right to, let's say, right, try to stop the car and save your life. Even if that means that it might turn out that someone else will die. You're allowed to try to stop yourself or something like that. Or right, in a car accident, right? You're allowed to try to stop yourself. You don't have to start calculating, right? If my trying to stop myself from getting into a car accident, will that cause, right, other cars to, right? Like, you don't have to make those calculations, right? That seems one direction. You have the right to try to save yourself. I forget who it was who said, but okay. Someone on this side of the room said, but okay, what if you want to? What if you want to give up your life? You have the right to do that, to save other people. So that's a bit complicated as well. But the Gemara seems to indicate that you can. The Gemara tells the following story in 25. Again, I'll say it outside. Where these two people, Lulainus and Pappus, admitted to a murder that they didn't commit, so the Romans would put them to death rather than take it out on the city, even though they weren't responsible. They admitted that, right, to a crime they didn't commit to save other people. So it does indicate under certain circumstances, you may not have the responsibility to give up your life in that sense, but you have the right, right? You have the right to give up on that right of self. You have the right to give up on the right of self-preservation, right? It's a right. It's not a responsibility. Of self-preservation. So, what does that lead us to? So again, we're not going to come to firm conclusions here. But what do you get? So again, the decisions. If you had a single individual driving the car, you would say that on balance, the decision should be made in favor of deontology, meaning always being passive, never choosing to kill someone, with the possible exception of cases where the act that you're doing is defined as you trying to save yourself, right? I try to stop the car so I don't get into an accident, and if that means that a car in front of me might crash, right? You know, you think about this, right? Someone, the wheels start going out of control, right? So you try to slam on the brakes, right? Rather than actively, you know, turning into the wall and killing yourself, you don't have to do that, right? You can try to slam on the brakes, even though you know that if, right, it might be that by slamming on the brakes, right, a car behind you, right, there'll be a, whatever, right? It'll lead to a car accident, other people might die, you don't have the responsibility to turn off onto the shoulder and smash into a wall, right? You're allowed to try to save yourself, and what happens, happens, right? That's, right, self-preservation would allow you to do that, whether you have to do that, right? Maybe you're allowed to say, you know what, I'll smash into the wall, rather than, maybe, right? Meaning it's a suffix, right? I have to get into it. Could I actually kill myself? The possibility that it's maybe we're allowed to bring in utilitarian concerns if you can solve the deontological problem by saying maybe the act I'm doing is saving. But again, that's not clear. We saw that's a machlok, and the Chazon Ish isn't sure about that. What really complicates this even more, right, where at least we have some indication, oh, hello, how are you? Like, I've been here like half, you know, it was half the year, I haven't even said hello. How are you?
No, he's just on the next.
Okay, well, good to see you. The problem here, as I said, is that this is complicated by the reality that what? It's not the individual making the decision. Again, now at this point, this should be clear why this is complicated. Because it's complicated enough when it's individual. But you could say, look, the one thing we've learned is that deontologically, right, deontology wins unless it's about self-preservation, where self-preservation is a little bit different. With self-driving cars, again, the real problem, and this is why it gets so murky, is that on the one hand, there is no self-preservation because the question isn't on the person buying the car, it's on the programmer. Right, the person programming the car. So maybe here it's, on the one hand you might say, just prefer passivity to activity. That's one possibility. On the other hand, you might say that no, because a self-driving car has no moral culpability, so maybe, Dafka, everything we've seen is irrelevant. Because if there's no one who would be defined as a murderer, right, you have the right to go purely in the direction of consequentialism. Additionally, you might say that self-preservation is irrelevant because the car doesn't need to save itself. But on the other hand, you might say that self-preservation is relevant because, as I said, there's two questions. One is what should be programmed. The second is, can you expect anybody to buy such a car? Now, Rabbi Broid, when I was talking to him, said, yeah, but it gets more complicated because there's two possibilities in terms of programming. You could say that you could have some cars which will be utilitarian in nature and some which will have self-preservation programmed in, and therefore the choice is on the driver. But alternatively, the government can make a decision and say, we determine it based on utilitarian concerns, and therefore the answer is, do you want a self-driving car at all, knowing that it won't preserve you, yes or no? Right? And therefore you could take it away from them. Is that a right thing to do societally? And these are where we have the principles, but how you actually apply them gets very, very murky. As murky as it is in the original case, it's even murkier when you're dealing with something which itself has no deontological responsibilities. You're dealing with a government which is legitimate to take more utilitarian concerns into effect, and it's not clear whether self-preservation is legitimate. On the one hand, yes, it is because someone needs to buy the car, and maybe they're allowed to buy the car that will preserve them. On the other hand, maybe the government should set a policy that will always, right, save the most number of lives. And just, I need to look at a few sources quickly. I gave you here a tshuva, the Chasukei Chemed, where he writes as follows. I'll say it outside. He said, look, when it comes to an individual, the halacha always is, if you have someone in front of you that you can save, so then you don't make calculations about, should I save this person or save the money to save more people in the future, right? You don't make that decision. It's individual. But he asked Rabbi Yashiv, and Rabbi Yashiv said, yeah, that's great for an individual. But when it comes to the government, and the question is, how do I set a policy? That's not necessarily the case, because maybe when it comes to policy, you have to set up the policy that in the long term will save the most number of lives, right? And maybe that's the difference, that governments have the right or responsibility to be consequentialist, while individuals don't. And he writes, "Tzadik dvarim lefnei mori v'chad imigarner gan rebel yashiv shlita v'lo kiblaim mishum shesof sof atipul nimratz v'b'giyam atzilat mamash chaim rabim." Lachen alav bishul fi klalei mitzvot yitachen zerech latzel mishul faneinu b'chol zom begin lefashod mitzvah l'adam latzel mashiyot teran hashem k'shem shiuach nevesh docheh kol ha-torah u'gam docheh klalim elu shechol lefaneinu kodem. He said this notion, at least of governmental and societal pikuach nevesh, overrides even the normal principles of pikuach nevesh. Right, because kolzo v'nogel l'trumat nadiv, an individual, fine, v'nodal l'adifut shezichim l'nkara v'shuyop, but when the government has to set up things, they have to. Hashelam levatech malchakat hashtalot, malchakat tipul nimratz, right, he said, therefore, when I'm deciding which, let's say, which type of wing in a hospital to give money to, right, they don't have to figure out who right now, do I always have to give to the emergency medicine? Right, that's really his argument. Do I always have to first build his emergency medicine, but I build other parts of the hospital? He said, a government can't just always say, I have to do what's, right, the most, right, pressing. It has to think long term. And that's what complicates this issue, is that whatever we conclude about the individual, self-driving cars is on the one hand potentially a government decision, but potentially not, because someone has to buy the car. And that's really where the moral tension gets even more complicated. Now,
unless you set a date where everyone has to buy a car,
Correct, right? And then you could get into that. Now, of course, you could get into interesting questions, which is, if it's determined that self-driving cars are safer, are you morally responsible to buy a self-driving car rather than a car that you drive, right? And eventually, this will be a shaila, right? I think something we have to think about it in the future, but at least I'll throw out the question, which is, in the future, right, let's say the reality is that most cars on the road, or many cars on the road, are self-driving. They're similar price. But I like driving. Am I allowed to do that? Right? Am I allowed to drive knowing that I'm putting people's life at risk in a way I wouldn't if I was in a self-driving car? Right? Are you allowed to do that? Right? Are you allowed to have a... Right? Are you allowed to take a... Right? Are you allowed to do that? Right? You just enjoy the feel of driving. Can you do that? That's a question we're going to have to tackle eventually. Now, if... we would indeed conclude that government is different, so then we do have rules of triage. I gave you the Mishnayot in Huriot, right? Kohen, Kodem, Levi, things like that. So potentially we'd have to look there, I don't know, right? There are rules of triage that we could look at. What about old versus young? So again, normally we say no, but the Sefer Hasidim, it's quoted by Margalit Rayam, at saying that... maybe you can, and take this into account, that he says maybe it's a worse sin to kill someone who's young than someone who's old. Now, that doesn't, now obviously you're never allowed to murder someone, right? But again, if you think that there is preference and triage to young people, so maybe on an individual basis you'd never do that, you save whoever comes first, but maybe again when the government is making policy, these things that on an individual basis are out of bounds, maybe are inbounds on the level of programming. So just to sum up what we've seen, the reason this issue is so complicated is because for an individual, I can point with 90% surety that the Gemara tells you always have to prefer passivity. Right? With the possibility, though very questionable, that if I'm engaged in the act of saving, that legitimates turning the vehicle. The Gemara also thinks that it's legitimate under many circumstances to make the calculus in favor of saving myself, even if that might put someone else at risk, right? Because, right, someone's about to ram into me, I'm allowed to stop even that'll kill them, but it'll save me, right? I can do that because self-preservation isn't about guilt, right? There's a right there. How expansive? We can get into it, but clearly that shifts the balance. What makes self-driving cars so complicated is that in addition to answering these questions, which themselves are hard to answer, is this complexity, when you're dealing with the government, it's possible that there we're supposed to move to a consequentialist model. There we're supposed to deal with questions of triage, and there it might be legitimate, for example, to program it in if you could, to prefer, right, saving a young person over an old person and things like that. Maybe that's legitimate. We don't know, because for an individual it's not, right? But maybe at a triage moment it is, and maybe when you're programming in advance and you have the ability to program it, because it's in a calm moment, it's not in the heat of the moment, you're allowed to, and maybe that's the government's responsibility. On the other hand, if you really, really believe in the right to preservation of life, so maybe there is no way for halacha to force someone to buy a car that's not going to prioritize their life, based on consequentialist grounds. And that's really what the moral quandary is. So what I hope we've done, you've seen today, is not, again, I don't have a firm answer. I don't know if anyone has firm answers on these questions. But when you see the sort of the ethical literature, and if you look at the end of the source sheet, the MIT thing, and you want to test your own intuitions, right, what do you think? Again, there's not a right or wrong answer. This is test your intuitions. What do you think? Halacha definitely has what to say about it, but right, it has input, it talks about these fundamental philosophical issues, but it's very hard to pin down how this would play out. So I don't have conclusions of exactly how we should program it. I know the ethical issues that go into it, I know the complexities that have been added by the self-driving car. What conclusions we reach, I don't know. I'm in about as much dark as everybody else, but at least you understand the issues that that go into the question. Yeah.
What if we create an external technology that we require every car to have that was a recognition of a self-driving car versus a manual drive car? So, like, a self-driving car would be able to identify next to it if there was a vehicle that was self-driving, and they could...
And that... Look, there are all types of possibilities, right? You could, you know... Yeah, I mean,
like if the possibility of external technology making it slightly more safe.
Correct. I mean, we could do that, right? We could come up with all types of cases, right? You could say, right? Yeah, I mean, we could come up with all types of cases, right? If we determine that it's less ethical to drive your own car because you're putting people in danger, because it's not as safe as self-driving cars, does that mean the self-driving car should prefer the life of someone in a self-driving car because, right? The people in the self-driving cars have chosen to enter into the safer situation. The person who's driving manually has chosen to be in a more dangerous situation, both in terms of their own life and endangering other people. Maybe that changes the calculus. Right? All those
self-driving cars will be a lot more expensive than manual cars, especially at first, and then you're choosing people who are...
Correct. Correct. The beginning, right? The beginning, that'll be true, but at what point will that not be true? Again, these are all complicated, right? I'm saying these are all complicated triage questions. Yeah.
I feel like there are other problems with self-driving cars. Like, let's say they become hackable.
Correct. There's a million questions, right? Should we encourage them? Yeah, if they're hackable, right? Because then you could have this, right? You could have this terrorist nightmare, right? Instead of just, right, the possibility of them, you know, getting into the subway system, they could, you know, I don't, you know, they could hack all the cars. I don't know, right?
That happened in Doctor Who.
What?
That happened in Doctor Who.
Look, there are other questions. Again, to throw them out, other questions. We've just dealt with the life-saving questions. But there are other questions. There are, obviously, the monetary question, right? Are you really responsible? Let's say the programming was done by somebody else, right? So on the one end, you might say, it's my car, I'm responsible, Mamana Mazik, right? Probably you are, right? If your car, self-driving car, rams into someone else's property, you probably have to pay them. But, you know, you could come up with an interesting case, right? What happens if it rammed into somebody's property to save a life, but, right, I didn't program that, I didn't do that, right? The government made that decision, right? That's what it was going to do. That's the right decision, right? But does that take responsibility away from me, right? We'd have to talk about things like this. Obviously, you can give a totally another share on Shabbos, right? How does this affect Shabbos? Can I get into my self-driving car if it's pre-programmed on Shabbos, right? How does that, what if it's an electric car which is pre-programmed on Shabbos, right? How does that work, right? Because then you're not dealing with starting a fire, right? You have all types of issues like that. You know, people will have the ethical questions. If self-driving cars will take away taxis, right, what does that do? If it'll increase traffic because you can program your self-driving car to be a taxi driver, right, this is one of the things they're worried about, right, that instead of cars being parked, right, you'll just let them go around and be hired out like, right, as self-driving Ubers. Is that unethical?
Is that a bad thing?
What? Or is that a good thing, right? Because since cars spend 90% of their life parked, right, maybe people will share self-driving cars and maybe we're responsible to get them to decrease the number of cars on the road because then we'll just share self-driving cars as Ubers among, right? There's all types of interesting manifestations of things that could happen with self-driving cars that each deserves a share in and of itself. I just discussed, you know, probably the most pressing ones that people are talking about now most intensively. People are talking about the other issues. Admittedly, not with the same intellectual rigor as the life-saving issues. Yeah?
I just don't like the idea of saying that autonomous vehicle isn't morally culpable for making decisions.
Well, it doesn't make decisions, so it's not deontologically responsible. The programmer is responsible, but that might... Correct, but that... But
it's an issue of...
Co- Correct, but you're standing in a moment where you're not making any decisions. So again, you could say this is the exact same, that programming a car to choose to be active is the equivalent of murder. You could say no, that is just choosing triage, because the moment it's not a live question yet. Right? They're just making a decision. Neither of them are in danger yet. Right? That's the problem. Is on the one hand, you could say, yes, it's exactly like an individual. Program it the way you would if you were driving. On the other hand, you could say, no, but this isn't a live question. No one's life is in danger. I need to program it to decide. And that's where it gets really tricky. Again, this is why I don't have great answers. I know what the factors are. But the answers, I don't know. But I hope at least I've given you an understanding. And again, I encourage you, if it's something that interests you, to go to the MIT website, right? Go through those 13 cases. It really is fascinating to see all the manifestations, what you think when you're sort of put to the test, what other people have said, what other people's intuitions are. I know you have to get the bar a lot, so let us.